Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on January 25 during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. This podcast has not been edited for sound quality.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on the Noel Canning versus NLRB decision on recess appointments and the CFPB's recently propounded rules on residential home mortgages. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future, and unlike many of our teleforum conference calls, this call is open to the press. Today we're going to proceed a little bit differently than we normally would. We're very pleased to welcome three experts on our call today. We have for only a few minutes Noel Francisco of Jones Day. He's only with us for a few minutes. He's going to lead off talking about the Noel Canning case, which he argued in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and talking about the decision as well. We're going to take some questions from the audience for Mr. Francisco after his opening remarks. We're then going to hear opening remarks from Professor John Eastman and then Professor Todd Zawicki. And after that, we're going to return to the audience for additional questions. So with that introduction, I'll remind folks that the longer bios for each of our presenters are available on our website, and turn things over to Noel Francisco for the opening remarks. Go right ahead, Mr. Francisco.
Thanks very much, Dean. Thanks to the Federal Society for inviting me to be on this call. We got a great decision out of the D.C. Circuit today in the Noel Canning case. The court issued a strong opinion based on the text and the original understanding of the Constitution that ultimately held that the president's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were unconstitutional. It addressed the issue in two different ways based on the text. First, it made clear that the recess appointments power could only be exercised during an inter-session recess, that is, a recess that occurs between sessions of Congress, as opposed to the short breaks that occur while a single session is in existence. It then went on to say that, in addition, the power could only be exercised for a vacancy that arose during the recess, again, drawing directly on the clause's plain text. And putting those two together, the court had no trouble concluding that these particular appointments were unconstitutional. One larger picture point that I'd like to emphasize here that often gets lost in these kinds of arcane separation of powers cases is that principles of separation of powers, principles of federalism, they're not about Congress versus the president or the president versus Congress. Ultimately, all of these protections are meant to circumscribe the power of the government in order to limit the government's power vis-a-vis the people, here vis-a-vis the Noel Canning Company. So at the end of the day, it's not a victory for Congress, it's not a victory for the president, it's a victory for the Constitution and the principles of limited government. I'm happy to take a few questions.
Thank you very much, Noel. Let's open the floor to questions now. In a moment, everybody's going to hear an announcement that the floor is open. After that, to indicate you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on, please. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the first question. And Noel, just let me know when you feel you're going to run out of time. But let's go to the first caller.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. I'm wondering how you think this is going to play out. Obama is, probably not going to take this sitting down. Do you think I'm wrong about that? Do you think the court will ultimately stay its order? What do you think is going to be the timing of going to the Supreme Court? Do you think the court is likely to take this? And what do you think will happen to Cordray, since he wasn't explicitly referenced?
Well, I certainly don't want to speak for what the government will or won't do, but this is certainly a very important decision that makes a very important statement about presidential power and goes in a way that neither, frankly, this president nor many past presidents would have agreed with. So I think that there is a very good chance that you see the Department of Justice seek rehearing before the full D.C. Circuit and ultimately seek review in the U.S. Supreme Court. And we now have a circuit split. The D.C. Circuit could have decided this case in a different way that didn't create a circuit split, but the way they did decide it creates a clear circuit split. So I think that there is a good possibility that this case ultimately ends up before the U.S. Supreme Court. In terms of Richard Cordray's appointment, obviously this reasoning applies directly. Richard Cordray was appointed on the same day, pursuant to precisely the exact same assertion of executive power. So just for the very same reasons that the D.C. Circuit held the NLRB appointments are unconstitutional, so too is the appointment of Richard Cordray.
Okay, we've got a number of questions pending. If you have a question for Noel Francisco at this point, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Bill Emanuel in Los Angeles. Congratulations, Joel. My question is, do you have any idea how the NLRB is going to react to this? Will they continue functioning and until the Supreme Court decides otherwise, or what?
You know, it's hard to say, but they're certainly going to have to make some very difficult decisions. NLRB, every order that the NLRB issues can be appealed to the D.C. Circuit, which means that every order that they issue will be under a cloud. So they certainly could continue issuing orders in the hopes that they ultimately win this in the Supreme Court, or they could sort of stay their hand and let it play out and see if they can get a more favorable ruling from the Supreme Court, or at least more a complete and final statement from the judiciary. But ultimately, that's going to be up to the NLRB to decide on how they want to respond to this.
Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Laurie Callahan. Basically a simple question. Then you didn't respond to the question regarding the stay. Is it possible that this could be stayed pending appeal to the Supreme Court, or is it's unlikely?
I think it's unlikely given the way that NLRB orders work. NLRB orders are not self-executing. So in effect, when the NLRB issues an order, it's really just a piece of paper until one of two things happens. Either the party who it's issued against moves, asks the Court of Appeals to review it, which is what happened in our case, or the NLRB asks a court to enforce it. So I'm not really sure that a stay would be applicable here. But, you know, that's something the government may have a different view on. It. If they raise the issue, we'll address it.
Thank you.
I can take one more question.
Okay. Let's go to the next caller.
No, Mike O'Neill from Landmark Legal Foundation. Just wanted
to
congratulate
you. Hey, Mike, congratulations. And you,
yeah,
too, on the fantastic brief you guys filed.
Thanks a lot. It's a great day for us. Just wanted to kind of expand on Kurt's question there. Any early predictions on how this might break down in front of the Supreme Court if we get there?
Well, you know, I mean, if we get there, I could lose a lot of money predicting what the Supreme Court is going to do. I think we've got very strong arguments that will appeal both to the originalists on that court, as well as to more conservative justices who believe that even if you're not going to go back to the original understanding, you've got to draw certain lines around it, and even to some of the more liberal justices who understand that if you apply a more pragmatic test here, pragmatically these recess appointments didn't make any sense. You know, I always hope when I step in that I'm going to get them all, and here I think we've at least got a shot at them all.
I think so, too, but great job. Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks, Dean, for having me on the call.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to Noel Francisco. Thank you, Noel, for joining us, especially on such short notice. Let's turn now to our other presenters. John Eastman of Chapman University Law School is waiting to make his opening remarks. Go right ahead, Professor Eastman.
Thanks, Dean, and what a terrific day for Noel and his legal team, and thanks all to the amici support that he received on this case. The constitutional provision at issue here is in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 3, and it's very simple. The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. And, of course, that clause is there so that the operations of government didn't come to a standstill if there was an emergency vacancy and the president needed to, say, fill the Secretary of War position in the middle of a war when Congress was not in session. And so during those recesses, the president had the ability to make sure the operations of the government could continue. There's been a bit of mission creep over the 200 years since that clause was written, where the recess between sessions of Congress was then viewed that, well, we can make appointments for extended recesses during a session, and we overlooked the language that said for vacancies that happened during the recess and allowed for recess appointments for vacancies that had been pending on the Senate's docket for a long time, and they were just objecting to the president's appointment. And then the President Obama in 2011-2012 took it the further step that I think led to this court decision. And he said even though the Senate is technically in pro forma session, they're not doing any work over there right now, and so I'm going to deem that myself to be a recess, and I'm going to make these appointments that have been sitting over in the Senate for some months because they were so controversial. I'm going to put them on the National Labor Relations Board and let them start acting as a block, against companies that were trying to protect various right to work laws that they were fighting. That's what led to this court decision. And Judge Sentell, for the three-judge panel in the D.C. Circuit, I think quite properly looked at the language of the Constitution and said what the president did here was illegal. There's a reason the Constitution has separation of powers and checks and balances. Our founders were rightly concerned that when you consolidate all power into a single person or a single branch, you run the risk that that power will start being exercised tyrannically. And our Constitution is full of these checks and balances. And the president has a tremendous amount of power with appointments, for executive branch appointments as well as judicial appointments. But to check that power so that it couldn't be abused, so that it couldn't become tyrannical, the Senate has a key role. And any principal officers of the United States, judicial or executive, are nominated by the president and can only be appointed after the Senate confirms them. And then you have this one exception that the recess appointments clause allows for emergencies. It is not to become a normal course of action, as the president seems to believe he could make, because then that destroys the notion that the Senate has any check on the president's power at all. I think it's a long overdue and very welcome decision by the D.C. Circuit in this case today.
All right, let's turn next to Professor Todd Zwicky of George Mason. This call, for those of you who got the early advertisements, was designed to discuss exclusively Professor Zwicky's article on the recently propounded residential home mortgage rules by CFPB, and the call's been a little bit hijacked. I appreciate your indulgence in this, Todd Zwicky, and I want to apologize to those members of the audience who were expecting the call to exclusively discuss those issues. And with that apology, let me turn things over to Professor Zwicky for your opening remarks, Todd.
Thanks, Dean. And even though, in some sense, this is distinct, and in many ways, it's consistent with the points that I've been concerned about, and in particular, what this tells us about the structure of CFPB. So I want to start just by picking up on what Noel and John have said, say a few words about what this means for CFPB, and then specifically, and Richard Cordray's appointment, and then more generally. Where things go from here. The first thing I would say is I'm not familiar with anybody who thinks that that the Cordray situation could be distinguishable from the NLRB situation, which is to say that the assumption has been that the two rise and fall together, which is if the NLRB appointment was invalid than Cordray's was. If anything, it's the case that the NLRB appointments might be more plausible than Cordray's appointment, especially within the overall constitutional context. Because in some ways, the recess appointment of Cordray was more egregious than with the NLRB, because the way the CFPB is structured, as people will know, is it essentially has no effective congressional or presidential oversight. The director is appointed for a five-year term, removal only for cause by the president with advice and consent of the Senate. Congress has no control over appropriations and the like. And so the way the CFPB is set up, virtually the only control that the executive or judicial branch, congressional branch has over the CFPB was the initial, or congressional branch at least, was the initial confirmation of the director, which was end run in this case by this, what now turns out to be invalid, bogus recess appointment. There's a second problem that this raises with respect to the CFPB, also more broadly, which is a statutory problem, which is that the way the CFPB statute is written, when the CFPB first went into operation, the oversight functions that the federal government had previously exercised through, say, the Federal Reserve, immediately transferred to the CFPB. What did not immediately transfer, though, were new powers to supervise, like non-bank lenders, such as debt collection agencies, payday lenders, and the like. And those were, under the statute, to be transferred only upon the naming of a confirmed director under the statute. And the statute itself defined the confirmed director is somebody subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. So one additional challenge that the CFPB would have beyond the constitutionality will be the statutory problem, which is that its powers remain limited until there is a confirmed a director. Now, the overall effect of this, obviously, is as Noel was saying with respect to the NLRB, is that basically any order that the or any regulation the CFPB has issued would seemingly be now invalid. Most notably, the big rulemakings on mortgages, for instance, and the remittances rule, and a rule setting terms for remittances. That is the basis of the challenge by the Texas Bank to the CFPB statute. Those presumably would be invalid. CFPB has also issued final rules with respect to these non-bank lenders over whom they are asserting authority simply because they believe that Cordray was a confirmed director. Presumably those are invalid as well, not just on their terms, but also with a lack of jurisdiction. Another peculiarity about this is that the CFPB, in this this effort to insulate from all political pressures, has yet another constitutional defect, I think, but it's certainly a peculiarity, which is that the director is the only person who is actually confirmed by the Senate. The deputy director of the CFPB is appointed by the director himself. So the question would be, is if the director is has been invalidly appointed, does that mean the deputy director was an ultra vires appointment as well? And the answer presumably being yes. So whereas in most agencies, the deputy director could become the director, presumably, if they were properly confirmed, here there's nobody who's been confirmed by the Senate. That's always been a problem, but it's a particular problem here, in which case then presumably the Vacancies Reform Act kicks in. And essentially what we're talking about now is a de facto headless agency, or one subject to a non-political appointee of the Vacancy Reform Act. So I think that that this clearly affects Cordray's appointment, perhaps even in ways that are various and perhaps even more far-reaching than just the NLRB. With respect to my more general observation about the CFPB and the mortgage qualified mortgages and ability to pay rulemaking, the point I wanted to make there is that and to some extent it's identified in all this, which is that the extraordinary level of independence from oversight that the CFPB exercises has been justified from the beginning under the myth that the CFPB was going to be an evidence-based policymaking agency that essentially would base all its decisions on science and economic science rather than tawdry political concerns and that sort of thing. And I think if you wade through the 800 pages of the rulemaking by the CFPB this past week on mortgages, it demonstrates exactly the opposite, which is that it tells us that if you look at the way in which data is massaged and studies are characterized in that document, what you see is that the decisions that this agency is making are and must be inherently political, which is that the data do not speak for themselves. The studies do not speak for themselves. And there are some situations where it is pretty much indefensible, the spin that the agency puts on various different studies in order to justify its rulemaking. I take away two things from that, which is, number one, recognizing that that science does not speak for itself in this sense, and recognizing it's political, shows us why the idea of a sort of a single-headed dictatorial agency in the format of the CFPB is not a fruitful way to set this up. One may or may not like independent agencies, but it shows that it demonstrates the case for why agencies that are going to be insulated from typical executive control and the like should be, in my view, set up as commissions rather than single-headed agencies, which is commissions at least guarantee some degree of internal adversary process, whereas what we see here is the CFPB issuing this gigantic document with these tendentious characterizations of studies to support its results, and really very little way to rein them in, other than, you know, a very diligent law professor like myself trying to say things. So I don't think that's a very healthy way to make policy, and I think it proves the case for why at least a commission would be an appropriate structure. I think the second thing that the rulemaking does demonstrates why Congress should have an oversight power here. Congress has very little oversight power. There's no control over a budget. And in particular, one of the things that that the CFPB does there that I've been concerned about from the beginning is some people may recall that when the CFPB was first introduced, it had this sort of cockamamie theory of that they would give preferred preference to so-called plain vanilla products. Banks would be required to offer these plain vanilla products and essentially have consumers affirmatively opt out of them. Congress laughed that down for very good reasons: the impact it would have on innovation, all kind of problems that would have for consumers. What we see CFPB doing, I think, with the qualified mortgages rulemaking is essentially reinstating plain vanilla through the back door, which is that they're basically going to use the rulemaking process to get what Congress specifically told them that they did not want. The way they do it here is, rather than requiring offering certain products, instead what they do is they say, if you offer these products that we like, you will get a safe harbor. If you do not, then you're taking your chances, and thereby essentially providing very strong incentives to offer essentially the rules that they would the products that they would characterize as plain vanilla plain vanilla mortgages and the like. I think that Congress should be very concerned about making it very clear that it didn't want that kind of heavy-handed guidance in the marketplace. Should be very concerned about CFPB essentially reinstituting through the back door of rulemaking something that it was shot down as part of the legislative process. And I'll stop there and open it up to questions.
Thank you very much, Todd. We're going to return to questions from the audience in just a moment. Before we do that, let me announce our schedule for next week, at least at this point. Next week, we're going to be hosting Teleforum calls on Tuesday and Thursday. On Tuesday at noon, we'll be discussing the greenhouse gases litigation, also in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, also something that promises to be a big case that's already been to the Supreme Court and returned to the D.C. Circuit. That's Tuesday at noon. On Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing class action litigation against the food manufacturing industry. That's Thursday at 2 p.m. For a complete schedule of upcoming Teleforum calls, and you can see today that these do change for next week and beyond, please visit the Federalist Society's website. Let's return now to the audience questions. If you have a question for either Professor Eastman or Professor Zawicki, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead, caller. You might be on mute. You might need to unmute your telephone. Okay, it sounds like we might have trouble with that line. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, go ahead, caller. This is Quentin Riegel from the NAM. There was a question earlier about staying the mandate, and there was an order issued today. I just wanted to clarify that. There was an order from the court staying the mandate until the disposition of a timely petition for rehearing or petition for rehearing on bank. So at least as far as the D.C. Circuit goes, the case has stayed until they finally resolve it.
Yeah, very good. Let me add, I think Noel Francisco's point earlier was it may not matter much given the way that NLRB orders are enforced and they need court action anyway. So I can't imagine even with the stay in place that the D.C. Circuit is going to allow the enforcement of the particular NLRB order at issue here. But the broader consequences of this ruling are going to be on hold a bit until a petition for rehearing or a cert petition is filed.
Todd Zwicky, you have anything on this point?
No, I don't have anything on that point.
Okay. Let me ask a question as well. Now, I understand that the NLRB appointments were made, I think, December 15th or mid-December, just before the Senate was scheduled to adjourn. In other words, these were not long-standing nominations that the Senate failed to act on. These were fairly fresh, made when I guess the president knew the Senate was about to leave town. Then the Senate left town, and then they were converted to recess appointments. Is that correct, Professor Eastman?
I think that's right. However, the vacancies were longer standing than that. The vacancies occurred in the summer before, and they had remained vacant through the fall, and then the president sent the nominations up right before the Senate went into these pro forma sessions. They didn't go out of session. They were in pro forma sessions, and we should talk a little bit about the difference there. This was something that the Democrats in Senate did during President Bush's administration to prevent him from making recess appointments. Their standard practice had become that over the Christmas break, they would take an extended, what they called a recess, for practice that had been in place about 40 or 50 years, maybe 70 years, but certainly not all the way back to the founding. Presidents looked at that as one of the sustained recesses that would allow them to make recess appointments. The Senate decided to alter its format and technically be in pro forma session where they met at least every 3 days during that extended break so that the Senate would not be deemed in recess and President Bush could not make any recess appointments. And President Bush did not make any recess appointments as a result of the Senate being in technical pro forma session. The Senate in 2011 decided to go into this pro forma session mode from December 20th all the way up to January 23rd, 2012. And the president claims that because they were in pro forma session, they were not doing any work, and therefore he deemed it to be a recess. But rather significantly, on December 23rd, during that so-called recess, or that pro forma session, the payroll tax extension bill was passed by unanimous consent in the Senate, and the president signed it into law. So the Senate could not, if they were not in session, they could not have taken that action, and the Payroll Extension Act would have been unconstitutional. So the president, you know, within a few days was making exactly the opposite arguments about the nature of what the Senate was doing in their pro forma session.
All right, thank you very much.
Todd here, I'll just add a few words because this is interesting background, just about Dean. In the Cordray situation, since I'll weigh in on that, it's a little bit different. What happened with him, as you may recall, was that he was there was a year in which, after the CFPB was created, there was a year for setting it up before it would actually start doing things. During that year, President Obama basically didn't nominate anybody, and he set up Elizabeth Warren to set up the CFPB out of the White House, basically as a political appointee. And so he never appointed anybody. Finally, after that year was up, basically, he decided to nominate Cordray, which basically guaranteed that they would not have a confirmed director at the moment that the agency launched. After he was nominated, the Senate filibustered his nomination, basically demanding certain structural changes to the CFPB, being a commission, giving oversight, giving budgetary oversight, and making it easier for the Financial Stability Oversight Commission to overturn CFPB regulations. Rather than negotiate on that, basically, then that was the point at which President Obama simply named him to the job. Now, the irony about that, and to some extent distinguishing this from the NLRB case, which is that lacking a quorum, the NLRB couldn't do anything. That was not the case with the CFPB, which is that because the way the CFPB was set up, the CFPB could have functioned perfectly fine exercising the powers that were transferred to it by other federal agencies without a confirmed director. They had a procedure in place that basically allowed somebody like an Elizabeth Warren to continue doing it. And it was only because they wanted to be able to make this power grab to assert control over non-bank lenders as you know, they get that augmentation to its power. They decided to go ahead and do this, as well as you know, sort of PR sorts of things. So, do have a situation here in which it wasn't necessary. The agency could have functioned perfectly fine without jumping the gun and launching a recess appointee. And in fact, just yesterday, when Mary Jo White was nominated to the SEC, Cordray was nominated by the president to be the permanent head of the CFPB.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about
no
that.
No worries.
Okay.
I didn't get your – did you email
it?
Right.
I emailed it through the Blackboard, and sometimes I don't know if those things go.
Let's go to our next caller.
This is Nick. I work in the Senate. Just curious what the folks opining on this feel about the long-term ramifications here. This is an incredible blow, I believe, to the president's executive ability to make recess appointments.
Don, you want to go first?
Yes, yes. I think it is, and it's even more substantial than what the president did here. He pushed the envelope. And the entire envelope is now closed. So what happens? You know, let's go back and revisit this. No president for the first 80 years of our history made an appointment in an intersession break. The recess, which is the language the Constitution uses, not just a recess, was specifically described as the break between sessions of Congress. There were two or three times from 1867 to 1920 where the president made an appointment in an extended, you know, month long break within a session, and then gradually after that the Congress started viewing, or the president started viewing, their recess appointment authority as any time Congress was out of session for more than 3 days, kind of drawing the 3 day analogy from another clause in the Constitution defining when the Congress has to get approval from each other if they take breaks for more than 3 days. That became the norm for a while, and it was that norm that the Senate tried to close by going into pro forma sessions where they met at least every 3 days to prevent the president from making recess appointments. President Obama pressed the envelope even on that, said, I don't care what you say, for how long you're out, I get to determine whether you're in recess or not. I'm determining you're in recess because you're not doing any work over there right now, and I'm going to make these appointments. And that caused the D.C. Circuit to go back and look at what the original meaning was. And they've said, it says the recess. That doesn't mean any recess or any adjournment. It's the recess. That's between sessions of Congress. And that's the only time when the president can make a recess appointment, and only for appointments that arise during that recess. So he can't sit on a vacancy for months, as he did here, and then send up a nomination right before they're going into even that recess, because that was not a vacancy that was caused or arose during the recess. And so I think this is a real significant reclaiming of the Senate's check on the president's appointment power.
I agree, and I think that it rebalances the system. I mean, quite simply, the way I understand the advice of consent to be set up is that it is an equipoise. It is balanced. We've come over time to think of it as this mighty presidential thing, but I think in reality it's more an equipoise, which is to say the president is entitled to nominate people but can't force the Senate to confirm them, and the Senate is entitled to confirm people, but can't force the president to nominate anybody, right? The Senate can't say, there's a vacancy here and you haven't nominated it, so we're filling it, right? It's a system in which, as John said, it's checks and balances. It's the president has the power to nominate, the Senate has the power to confirm. Obviously, this expansive use of the recess powers that's grown over time, in my view, upsets that that balance, and I think this puts it back in a balance that not only is consistent with what the framers intended, but any sort of common sense way in which we think that the recess appointment makes any sense within a system of checks and balances.
Very good. We've got a number of callers with questions. Let's go to the next caller. Go ahead, caller. You might have muted your phone. If so, you need to unmute your telephone.
A problem I had just a moment ago in reverse. I apologize for not muting my phone.
Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, great. It's Emmanuel Lowy, Compliance Complete Service for Thomson Reuters. With the D.C. Circuit's decision ruling against President Obama's recess appointment, can you say what this is likely to mean in terms of further lawsuits, surrounding the CFPB and its current structure?
Yeah, I'll just wait on that. I mean, there's one large pending lawsuit challenging a CFPB that I referred to earlier, brought by this bank in Texas. That statute has, case basically has four counts to it. One of it is the invalidity of Richard Cordray's appointment. A second one relates to the basically the ability to deem a bank systemically risky without any judicial review. Third relates to the resolution authority that is set up by Dodd-Frank. And the fourth relates more generally to the CFPB itself and the delegation of very broad and vague powers to the CFPB without appropriate oversight from Congress and the president, as I've described earlier. I think, if anything, the second and third issues may not be implicated by this, but that last one, I think, if anything, this relates to it, right? Because and adds teeth to that, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the only real protection that Congress had, or control, was the ability to confirm the director. And this takes away that ability to end run Congress. But I think it's, in so doing, what it does is it puts a brighter light on just sort of how lawless this agency is. And the complete lack of any institutional controls over this agency. So if you, for instance, even look at Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion in the Free Enterprise Fund case, he talks about the other sorts of controls in that case that he thought meant that the PCAOB was valid. If you run through that list of what Breyer thought should save the PCAOB, though, almost all those things are absent from the CFPB. So I think what this does is puts that whole bolsters that case and puts that whole organizational structure of the CFPB, of this broad delegation without any real controls over what's going on, into doubt by basically reminding us, as John and Noel did earlier, that these structural protections exist to protect individual liberty and individual rights. And so this strikes me as a relatively muscular a statement of recognizing that these sorts of formal, structural, and institutional issues matter a lot. So I think this adds weight to that additional argument about the whole structure and delegation of powers to the CFPB without appropriate oversight from the president or Congress.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Looks like we still have five questions left. We still got some time left. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Hi. This is Tom Curry from NBC News. It wasn't exactly clear from what you said. Any person who is affected by or is challenging a rule issued by the CFPB, would they have to now litigate to get a court to declare that what this agency has issued in terms of rules on mortgages or lenders or whatever, that these rules are invalid because the director is invalid? I mean, do you still have to litigate in order to win, or is there some earlier way this would be resolved?
Well, there's two ways in which it could be resolved, right? Which would be, one would be, yes, they could basically bring that action and ask for declaratory judgment. But the other would be that it would put the onus on the CFPB, which is basically they could take the position, we don't have to comply, for instance, we don't have to comply with the qualified mortgages rule because it's not a valid law. In which case, then, the way it would arise would be the CFPB would have to initiate an action to enforce it against the private person. And that is obviously a pretty dicey proposition with a clear ruling staring them in the face that the CFPB would go out and nonetheless start suing people. It would be a pretty high stakes gamble, I think, by the CFPB. They may have an argument, for instance, why for some reason their regulations are valid, even though their director is invalid. Certainly, that won't apply to non-bank lenders, such as the rule they issued earlier this week related to, or last week related to debt collection agencies, for instance. I don't think they have any leg to stand on when it comes to those sorts of entities. With respect to other entities, such as banks and they're enforcing the qualified mortgages rule, they would have to take the onus to enforce it if somebody wanted to say it doesn't apply. I wouldn't want to be in their shoes doing that, because that's a pretty aggressive that seems to be a pretty aggressive challenge to what seems to be a pretty clear opinion by the D.C. Circuit. Perhaps John disagrees with me on that, but it strikes me that those are effectively dead letters until this is resolved, because I just can't imagine them trying to force these rules with this sort of shadow hanging over.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Although I guess where I would disagree is it wouldn't surprise me to see the different agencies say, well, that applied to the NLRB, it doesn't apply to us. We're going to keep operating as if nothing happened. Look, there seems to be this misperception out of the Office of Legal Counsel, elsewhere in the Department of Justice or the White House, that the Constitution's impediments are something to figure out a way around rather than to comply with. And you look at the parts of this opinion, the D.C. Circuit Judge Sentell, I mean, it's a thorough, very well-reasoned opinion. He takes on a 2012 Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that the president has discretion on his own to decide whether the Senate's in recess or not, available to perform its advice and consent function. Here's what the court says in response to it. This will not do. Allowing the president to define the scope of his own appointments power would eviscerate the Constitution's separation of powers. That's just so clearly right. And one wonders why people are trying to get around the Constitution and the limits on the exercise of its powers.
That was Professor John Eastman speaking. And before that, we heard first from Professor Todd Zawicki. Tom Curry, do you have a follow-up?
No, you've answered my question. Thanks.
All right. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, I'm unfamiliar with the structure of the CFPB. Does it have a board that has to pass regulations like the NLRB does? And if it doesn't, I can see why Mr. Cordray's appointment, if he's joined in the lawsuit or if the two cases are somehow joined at the Supreme Court level, could possibly invalidate those regulations. Otherwise, I'm not seeing how the onerous regulations, which were issued about mortgages earlier this week, would apply.
I agree. I mean, I've not heard anybody try to make an argument as to why they might, right? Other than if they could drum up some, I don't know what the argument would be. Perhaps John might know. Other than if they were issued in some manner in which they could be issued by somebody other than the director in the alternative or something like that. I don't see how that could possibly be the case. The structure of the CFPB is it is not a board, it is a single director. The director is appointed by the president, removable for a five-year term, removable only for malfeasance or dereliction of duty, and they're supposed to be confirmed by the Senate. And then basically the director has absolute control of everything else that happens within the agency, including appointing the deputy director. So I can't see any way in which the agency's rules could be valid while the director of the agency was invalid. I've not heard anybody make that argument, so maybe there's an argument, but it's hard for me to see how that would work.
And if you look, this is John Eastman again, if you look back at the court's decisions dealing with the distinction between principal officers and inferior officers or mere employees of the government, one of the roles of principal officers is to have this kind of policy judgment-making authority, and it's because rules or enforcement actions issued under that authority had already been vetted with the appointment process, with the Senate confirming a presidential appointment, that meets the constitutional test. You take that away, and all of a sudden you've got people without any accountability at all who hadn't been appointed going through that process, issuing rules and taking enforcement actions. That creates a constitutional problem of huge magnitude, it seems to me.
Yeah, and I'll just elaborate on that, which is I suspect for the reasons that John just well said, that the way the CFPB is structured is if, as I said, if the director is unable to act, supposedly the deputy director can act as the director. It's not clear that it would be valid, and I think it would probably be invalid, because at that point then you'd basically have somebody who wasn't subject to Senate confirmation acting as a principal officer, as a senior officer. So I think that's a completely independent constitutional defect or constitutional difficulty that's sort of been sitting inside of the CFPB that hasn't been that might create its own problems if they somehow tried to fall back on that.
At this point, we have three questions pending. Let's go to the next question. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Tom Odom. It strikes me that we have two different realms of dispute here, one between the branches of government, the constitutional separation of powers that's been the primary focus of discussion, but there's also the partisan political background that's going on here, and there is the chance that partisan politics overrides the institutional interest of the Senate in protecting its prerogative. And I'm wondering if any thought's been given to the possibility that the Senate might see this, at least the Democratic majority in the Senate might see this as a reason to abandon the filibuster.
Oh, that's a very good question, Tom. For their partisan outcome, I think they would. But the question they're going to be asking is, if we change the rules on the filibuster, is it going to come back to bite us when the partisan shoes are on the other foot? And that's been the large bear in the room that has not led them to change or modify those filibuster rules, because they can easily envision a time when they're back in minority status in the Senate where they'll want to have that power. So that's, I think, the calculus going on there, not so much being driven by the current fight over appointments. But I will say this. I think you're right. Partisanship has overtaken the institutional protection. I don't expect that if Bob Byrd were still there in the Senate, that no matter who was in the White House, a member of his own party or otherwise, would he have taken too kindly to a claim that the president gets to determine whether or not you're in recess and basically do an end around the confirmation process anytime I want. Senator Byrd would have in his marvelous way would have defended the institutional prerogatives there and recognized when they were being weakened and the consequences of weakening them, and the consequences are rather severe. The accumulation of powers in a single branch is a dangerous thing, no matter who's in charge of it, and it's why we have those separation of powers, and it's why Federalist 76, for example, talks about the Senate's role in making sure that the president doesn't put unfit characters in office. That's a very important thing, because unfit characters in office, particularly those that have the kind of powers over day-to-day operations of life, like the consumer agency does or the NLRB does, if they don't have any check to the political process, how can you rein them in when they start exercising their powers in an abusive way? And all of these things on the front end of the appointment powers and the checks on that were designed to make sure liberty could flourish without that kind of tyrannical government imposition on those rights.
Hey, Tom, Todd here. I'll just add a brief word to you, which is first, going back to CFPB, one of the interesting things, again, I think that this does tie in with partisan politics in two ways. One, more generally, is recall that the reason why the Republicans originally filibustered Cordray's nomination was that they wanted to tie it to certain structural reforms of the CFPB in terms of increasing oversight and accountability. I think it was an open question as to whether, subsequent to President Obama's reelection, whether or not the Republicans in the Senate would hang tough on that issue, which is to say, would they have ended up caving and allowing, confirming Cordray rather than appear obstructionist, because it's clear that Barack Obama is never going to reform this agency. I think one implication of this in terms of the partisan politics is that I suspect it probably gives new life to efforts in the Senate, of the Republicans in the Senate, to force much needed, I think appropriate reforms on the agency as a condition for confirming a permanent director. And I think that's that in the larger scheme of things, that's good. The second thing that's kind of an interesting wild card about this is, of course, in the political sense, is Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, of course, this is her old brainchild. She set it up, and now she's will soon be the senior senator from Massachusetts. What happens with her, and whether she presumably isn't going to be involved in some way of this game of trying to see what comes out of this. So those are partisan political issues related specifically to this in a different way in which you're asking about.
Let's move on to our next caller.
Hi, this is Evan Weinberger calling from Law 360. You might have addressed this question already, but in I think it was 1990, something fairly similar happened at the OTS. And a lot of the decisions of the OTS were upheld using the de facto officer doctrine. Is the CFPB situation, if Cordray is deemed improperly appointed, different? And how would you compare them?
I think it's a question, Evan. I confess I'd have to go back and look at that whole 1990 OTS issue. I haven't thought about that that connection. One of the things I would look at, for instance, would be, I'd have to look at, whether facts that distinguish the two cases. And in particular, one thing that strikes me is that the CFPB, everybody at the CFPB itself knew what it was risking when it decided to go forward, considering how controversial and risky this appointment was to begin with. I would think, among other things, that would have to matter with respect to these things. Secondly, there's been very little in the way of any serious reliance on the CFPB regulations, for instance. So, for instance, the remittances rule was issued last year, but hasn't even gone into effect yet. They gave a one-year period before it went into effect, and then they've even delayed that. The qualified mortgages rule also has I don't remember the exact date, but a phase-in period. So a lot of these things have been issued, but hasn't even gone into effect. So any sort of reliance interest would not be present here. It'd be much more likely, I would think, that they would just invalidate them because they haven't even gone into effect yet.
Okay.
Yeah, and if I recall, this is John Eastman again. If I recall the 1990 case, there were a whole series of just pretty routine decisions and just general operations of government that had been done, and they didn't want to unravel all that. They came up with this effective officer theory. That's clearly not the case in the CFPB, and arguably not the case in the National Labor Relations Board issues as well, particularly on any of the NLRB orders over the last year that have been issued that are still in process on seeking enforcement. If I were on the receiving end of those enforcement actions, I would be immediately moving to supplement my briefing in the enforcement action to raise a new defense that said that, you know, these things are unconstitutional. And I think given this decision, you'd have a very strong likelihood of success on those.
And what about the CFPB enforcement actions that have already been taken? Those are against banks. Would those be able to stand?
That's an interesting question. To the best of my I'd have to go back and look at those comprehensively, but to the best of my recollection, almost all of those were consent orders or settlements. I know there's other people on the call who may be in the audience who maybe know more about the details of those. But it is an interesting question, I think, about does this have an impact on settlements, consensual settlements, which is what a lot of those things were, and if so, what effect? But that's not that's an intriguing question to me, and maybe John has a view or somebody else, but I'm not exactly sure what the answer to that would be.
Yeah, okay. it's a very intriguing question. You enter into a settlement because you had an enforcement gun to your head that was based on an unconstitutional regulation by an unconstitutional officer. I would suggest that kind of illegal negotiating power might render the settlement invalid. Certainly, if I wanted to get out of the settlement, I would be making such an argument.
Although the settlements there were other agencies involved in those settlements. Does that change the equation a bit?
Yeah, it does. It does. It depends on which agency had the enforcement authority. And if there were multiple ones and other agencies that could have done the settlement by itself and they were duly appointed acting legally, then that settlement obviously would be on stronger grounds than one that was being driven by threats of enforcement of regulations that are invalid.
Okay. Got it. Thank you very much.
Well, Professors Eastman and Zawicki, we seem to be raising more questions than you're answering. We still have 7 questions pending. Let me ask you, you've been very generous with your time. We're just about out of time officially. Are you able to continue, or do we need to conclude in 3 minutes?
I can continue for a few minutes. Yep.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask our callers. We still have, looks like, 7 questions pending. I'll ask the callers to be as brief as possible in phrasing your questions, and we'll try to get through as many as possible.
This is Mark Scarberry at Pepperdine University School of Law. It seems the court dealt with two issues, namely when the appointment is made and when the vacancy arose. And either one of those, it seems, would have been enough to decide the case. Are both of those decisions now binding precedent within the D.C. Circuit, or perhaps only the one about when the appointment is made?
Mark, good question. I read the opinion as encompassing both. They've interpreted the clause and decided what it means. And this particular appointment failed on both aspects of it. I suppose you could come up and say the D.C. Circuit got it wrong on that the vacancy has to arise during the recess. That one was only unconstitutional because the president made an appointment when there was no recess in effect and run it. But these are alternative reasonings, and typically alternative reasonings both have equal weight in presidential value.
Well, John, I think you're right about that. The concurring opinion suggested that the second issue didn't need to be reached, but I think you're right.
Yeah, but that was one of the 3 votes, right?
Right.
Yep.
Correct. I would agree with that.
Very good. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Megan McArdle of Newsweek Daily Beast. Actually, I'm afraid a lot of callers have answered all of my good questions. But what ultimately, I mean, how fast is this going to unroll with the CFPB? What, you know, sort of steps do you expect to be see taken in the next few weeks, months, et cetera, and how fast is this probably going to get end up getting settled?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, they can't do anything right now. That's my view. Number one. Number two, as I said, it appears to me, it appears to me it's effectively a headless agency right now because you don't have a situation where I think the deputy director is probably invalid as well, in which case then the next question becomes the Vacancy Reform Act seems to take over here. I mean, assuming that they recognize that they can't operate, right? So the Vacancies Reform Act has particular rules that, as I understand it, would apply here. I don't remember the details. I looked at them, but I haven't gone back and looked at them again. But the Vacancies Reform Act presumably kicks in and determines who would run the agency. But I don't think the agency could really do much. Certainly, they couldn't reach the non-bank bank lenders. And the things that they've been doing on payday lending and debt collectors would be invalid. The things they've already issued on those would certainly be invalid, I think, under the statute. The second question then, I think, becomes this bigger political question, which is President Obama's renominated Cordray officially for the post, and whether or not, and I suspect the Republicans are going to re-up and basically demand a reform to the agency structure as a condition for confirming the director to the agency, and I think they have a pretty strong hand with that right now. That could go on for a very long time. This is very much tipped the balance, I think, back towards the Republicans on that fight, whereas I think President Obama's reelection had tipped the balance to him. So I would expect the Republicans will hang together on that, and you could end up seeing concessions along the lines of what the Republicans have requested from the beginning, and that could take some time then, in which case the CFPB could essentially be inoperative if this is upheld in any meaningful sense.
John Eastman, anything on this point?
No.
All right. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Kurt again. I just very quickly wanted to point out that I noticed that the deputy director of the CFPB, Raj, I think his last name is Date, had announced back in the fall that he'll be leaving at the end of January. So it's the question isn't whether he's no longer can act, but, you know, now whether Cordray can appoint a new deputy director, and I guess the answer is no.
I think the answer is obviously no. I don't know what, I don't know whether Date could say, oh, I've changed my mind now. I don't know what it means to say I'm leaving at the end of January. I mean, he's still technically the director, deputy director. The deputy director serves at the will of the director, so I don't know sort of what the legalities of that would be. There's also an interest that, and I'm not quite sure how Date the details of who appointed Date and that sort of thing, because he was running the agency in some sense before Cordray was. So it may be that there's a unique situation involving Date, because depending on how he was put into that job, because he dates back to when the agency was still being run out of the White House. And so maybe that there's some peculiarity involving him that wouldn't, for anybody who succeeded him if he were to be able to change his mind and stay on. But certainly it seems clear that if he goes, that it seems obvious to me that Cordray could not appoint a new deputy director, and there's simply no way in which a new deputy director could be appointed, as I understand the CFPB statute, once the agency was up and running and powers transferred from the Secretary of the Treasury.
Thank you.
Dean,
right, we have four. Go ahead, John.
I've got a stack of students piling up here, so I may have to go pretty quick.
Okay, let's take one final question.
Richard Ralph, California. Hello, Professor Zwicky.
Hi, Richard.
I was just curious as to the value in today's society compared to the one of 1787 or 89, of the recess appointment power, I mean, that was a 3-mile-an-hour world, and information took a long time to move, and congressmen and senators even longer. Just comment on that, please.
It sounds like what you're saying, Richard, is if anything, what we've seen over time is the recess power expanding, and if anything, it seems like it should be contracting. If that's what you're implying, I think that's right.
I share that view. If you're gone for 4 months at a time and can't hop on a plane and get to D.C. in order to do your advice and consent role, you need a recess appointment power. When you're a phone call away, you don't. And the presidents have expanded it in the modern technology the opposite direction. And I think this decision is going to have us rethinking that and not being able to use a recess of power to get somebody through that you couldn't get through the Senate confirmation process. And it'll bring the Senate back into a more formal and powerful role in serving as a check on presidential appointments.
I agree with that. I hope also that, you know, as a corollary, that it will discipline the Senate, and regardless of which party has it, that the Senate will take this responsibility seriously, and think about the implications. For instance, when the Democrats first started filibustering judicial nominations, what impact that initially had on the judicial branch. You know, how they weigh these things, I think, is they will determine. But this basically, I think, forces more discipline and a proper level of discipline on both the president and the Senate to both do their jobs properly.
Thank you.
Very good. John, do you have time for, let me put it this way. We've got three more questions pending. If you need to go,
why don't you drop off as
you need to.
Let's roll them real quick if we can.
Okay, next question. Go ahead, caller. You might need to unmute your phone if you put your phone on mute.
Sorry. This is Maureen Martin from the Heartland Institute. To go back to the NLRB for a minute, are there any particular outstanding decisions by the NLRB that might be cast in question right now? I was trying to go back through the summaries, and a couple looked important, but I wonder what you guys know about it.
Yeah, this is John Eastman again. I confess I'm not a daily watcher of NLRB reports.
Yeah,
the ones that come to mind were, of course, the big Boeing in South Carolina thing. I don't know where that is in the process and know whether that's at issue or not. But that would be the one that comes immediately to mind. But there have been a year of these things, and with a board that was fairly aggressive, and so I suspect that there's going to be a whole lot of reopening, even on enforcement actions that were already completed.
Right. There was one decision on the ability of a non-union member who had to pay dues under Beck, what kind of documentation that person had to get, and the board said it was just enough to if the union said, we incurred these lobbying expenses, but there didn't have to be any independent audit verification of it. So that looked important to me, at least.
Yeah, I would challenge that. And in the Knox versus SEIU case, the union was claiming that lobbying expenses included all of their political expenses to fight an initiative, because the legislative authority was the people, and so they thought politics was lobbying. The Supreme Court shot down that argument. And if something like that is coming back around through NLRB orders issued by an unconstitutionally constituted board, boy, I'd be all over challenging those.
All right, we're down to two questions. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Devin Watkins. If the D.C. Circuit opinion is upheld at the Supreme Court, because I assume that they're going to challenge this, and I assume the Supreme Court is going to take it, how does this affect, Judge Pryor, that was installed in the 11th Circuit by Bush, with his opinions, or, like, if he's in a panel of other judges, what does it do if one of the members of the panels wasn't properly appointed?
A couple of things. One, if I recall correctly, that was done during an intersession recess, which would not be violated by the order here. And then it was reaffirmed at the end of the next session, because the recess power appointment only...
Oh, you're definitely right. It was reaffirmed. I believe it was February 20th, 2004, which I don't think was
between sessions of Congress.
Yeah, all right. Then, you know, then we would certainly want to look at those. Although I'm not sure the court, in issuing a clarification of a rule here, is going to go back retroactively to all of the other kind of appointments, but maybe they would, and we would have to look at that.
Final question.
Yeah, my question is directed at the rulemaking process by the NLRB. They've issued regulations, and how do you view those as being treated automatically invalid, or would they have to be challenged the way decisions would need to be challenged?
I apologize. You broke up a little bit there, and I missed the question.
Yeah, my question goes to the rulemaking powers of the NLRB. They've issued regulations on various things, and would they be invalid, or would they need to be challenged to be attacked or to be set aside?
Yeah, you know, an agency that now has a problem with how they were constituted, I think, should independently review and say, you know what, those regulations were passed by a board that we did not have a quorum and therefore illegal, and we're not going to give them effect. I would hope that an agency would follow the court's ruling here and do the right thing. But if they don't, then they may be able to may need to be challenged in by way of raising defenses to any enforcement action on those regulations.
Yeah, I wouldn't see the
NLRB. Right, I think that's the way it would likely come up, would be an enforcement action on the regulation. It would be raised as a defense.
Yeah, thanks. I don't see this NLRB revisiting its prior rulemaking. But
right. Yeah. And so you would raise it by way of a defense to an enforcement action, or you could have a motion for declaratory action invalidating the regulations brought independently by somebody who believes that it might be enforced against them.
Thanks.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous with your time going over the scheduled call. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Todd Zwicky, John Eastman, and Noel Francisco for participating in our call today, especially for doing so on such short notice. I want to thank our audience for participating, for their questions as well, and invite you again to join our next scheduled Teleforum conference call next Tuesday at 12 noon, when we'll be roughly in the same court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, but looking at the greenhouse gas cases in that court. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoy this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit the Federal Society's website at federalsociety.org/multimedia.